The problem is, you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking, conversations with experts exploring all things psychology.
Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name's Nish Nikolic, and my guest today is Professor Sally Gainsbury, who's here to talk to us about gambling. Sally is a leader in gambling psychology research, focusing on using science to inform the development of responsible gambling strategies. Sally is a professor in the School of Psychology and director of Australia's only university-affiliated gambling treatment centre, the Gambling Treatment and Research Clinic, which is the lead gamble-aware provider for gambling treatment for individuals and significant others across Sydney. The Gambling Treatment and Research Clinic brings together the nexus of clinical and research excellence and aims to conduct applied research that translates to policies and practices to reduce gambling harms in the broad community. In her role as director, Sally oversees clinical treatment practices as well as engagement and outreach across relevant community, government, and industry stakeholders to prevent and reduce gambling. Professor Gainsbury leads the Brain and Mind Centre Multidisciplinary Technology Addiction Team, which aims to investigate the role of technology in addictive behaviours and mental health. Fascinating conversation today. What I really enjoyed from Sally is her non-judgmental approach around gambling, but rather a distinction around problematic gambling versus recreational gambling, and also understanding the importance of people who would like to participate in gambling having awareness, and through that awareness of their spend, for example, being able to consent to how they engage in gambling. Hope you enjoy this episode. It was a great pleasure to speak with Sally. Sally, a big thank you for coming onto the program today.
No problem. It's great to be here.
Look, I'm so excited to talk about gambling and particularly in the view of, you know, reasonable or sustainable or enjoyable gambling, something that is, you know, often not attributed to the behavior of gambling. There's usually quite negative connotations with that word. So I'm looking forward to having a conversation with you.
Perfect.
How did you get into this space of, you know, how did this become an interest spot for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like most Australians, I've grown up with gambling in the peripheral of my life. I had uncles who were fairly interested in horse racing. I was fairly active in the family, so it wasn't uncommon for one half of the family to have the races on in the background, that sort of thing. But mostly when I became more attention to it, when I started working in pubs, as you do, I was working down in the rocks to you know, earn my wages. I was studying a Bachelor of Psychology in Sydney. And I was in charge of doing the tab, filling out the forms on a Tuesday night and watching people put in, you know, 50 after 50 on the races while I was earning $14 an hour, thinking, you know, that's, you know, a lot of money. And I was in charge of the pokies room in some of the pubs in the Rock. So again, seeing people with, you know, $900 on the machines, again, I'm there pulling schooners and polishing wine glasses for, you know, $14 an hour, and thinking that is a lot of money, and they're leaving with nothing. And that just at the time, as a, you know, as a student, very aware of the cost of living, thinking this seems really irrational. Learning theory would predict that if you keep losing, you would realize that's going to happen. So why do they keep going back? So I actually started doing some research as an undergraduate student into this, you know, what is driving this mentality? And then I was fortunate enough to have at my university a very esteemed researcher in gambling, Professor Alex Blazinski, who, you know, unbeknownst to me, is actually one of the world's experts in gambling. So when I sort of approached him to do some extra studies in it, all of a sudden I had my own gaming machines in a lab that, you know, after changing New South Wales policy to get that approved, and I was all of a sudden doing these real world policy impact studies and having pretty high influence. And it was really rewarding to see that this is an understudied area. So by doing work in this field, I can make a difference on policy. And that's something that's just continued to fuel me is this isn't research for the sake of it. This is research that has lives at stake. And to be able to make a systemic change, that's what drives me every day.
And what were some of the policies when you first started out that you've been able to review, or I suppose look at research that might provide a better understanding and obviously influence how policy has changed in Australia over the years?
Yeah, my first research was looking at messaging. So it's this idea of a communication strategy, which is really the backbone of most public health areas. You know, the idea of informed consent, particularly in an individualistic society like Australia, where we believe that people are free to carry out actions provided they do so in a safe context. That means they have to be sufficiently informed, aware of the risks, and then, you know, we let them make their own decisions. However, it's certainly arguable that most people don't understand gambling, or at least there's a difference between the what we would now refer to. It's been more prominent in terms of hot and cold cognitions, this sort of behavioral economics approach that's, you know, the Nobel Prize was won for by Daniel Kahneman, looking at this idea that people can know something, but their behavior is actually driven by a belief that counters that knowledge. So we can understand that the chances of winning a jackpot are very, very low. But in our somewhere deep inside us, we still believe, but I might win it. That, you know, that might be me. And that drives behavior. So there's this disconnect between more informational knowledge and the kind of the beliefs we have. So my initial research was based on this idea that when people are gambling, they really get sort of in the zone. They're in the moment, they're in the, you know, the flow, whatever you're arguing, or whether you're a recreational gambler doing this socially, or whether you're experiencing problems and you've lost control and you have that sort of impaired ability to make rational decisions, that what we need to do is disrupt that state and sort of get people to stop and check in with themselves, because in the cool light of day, people are making different decisions than they are during a gambling session. So my research was based on this premise that not only do you have to communicate in an appropriate way with accurate information that's very specific and targeted, so we need to move away from these global statements of, you know, the chance of winning a jackpot. People know that's people aren't winning trying to win the jackpot. They don't expect to win the jackpot. But we need to shift this idea away to get people to think at the, you know, the immediate point of view. So my research in my undergraduate and postgraduate degrees looked at what's referred to as a pop-up message, where you have a break in play, a message pops up on the machine, and it has something that encourages the person to check in with themselves. So instead of providing people with information, we're actually just getting them to have this self-check-in. So I did a series of studies that, you know, as a good researcher, we start with a literature review, make sure what the underpinnings are. Then we do some lab-based research, and then we do simulated research in a venue. So I worked around to different venues in Sydney with my laptop, and I said, pretend this is a gaming machine, and I played the gaming machine on the laptop. And then I went into venue studies. So we actually did studies in venues, with, and that requires within gambling, it's a highly regulated area. So we needed government approval. We needed manufacturers to make them. We needed the central monitoring system to approve them. You know, we needed the venues to get in play. So it's a very complex area to do research in. And that series of studies demonstrated that having a break in play, you know, having a message that encourages people to think about themselves. So our message didn't say the chances of winning the jackpot are 1 in a million. Our message just said, do you know how much you're spending? That's a very different idea. It's non-judgmental. It's not accusing people of anything. It's relevant for everybody. And it's just that concept of we take a little break, a pause, stop, think, and check in. Okay, you're good to go, or maybe take a break. And that was really influential. And those signs are now in place in Canada. They've been discussed in Australia. There's pop-up messages in New Zealand, and online. So it's been a really impactful area to start making a change. It's not going to solve the issue of gambling problems, but we're stepping in that direction.
And what has been the effect of having a message pop up, during a break or between, I suppose, rounds, so to speak? I'm not sure what the right terminology
Yeah.
is.
Our messages show the people, after they see a message, they do take a break and they tend to moderate their gambling. We haven't seen it broadly implemented in Australia for gaming machines, but we have seen these implemented by various websites for online gambling. So, and that's the difficulty part about research, is my influence can get up to informing policy, but at the end of the day, it's up to policymakers, politicians to approve the legislative changes. And that then gets back to, you know, anyone listening, the community pressure. The more community pressure there is for a policy, the more likely it is to actually get legislated, because at the end of the day, regulators are conflicted, or state governments are conflicted, because they make a lot of money from gambling. So there has to be sufficient pressure on them to be able to change that, you know, change any agenda to reduce gambling harm in a significant way.
And has that messaging become a part of legislation in Australia, or it's still an optional for each, I suppose, venue to decide?
That particular legislation isn't in Australia, as far as I'm aware. It was going to be in Canberra, and there have been iterations over the years. Pop-up messages are in place in New Zealand and in Canada and other parts of the world. But Australia at the moment, I don't think, has pop-up messages on the machine as a mandatory break in play. But again, things are constantly changing. In New South Wales, we're looking at different systems, and there's proposals underway. So, you know, it's really constantly checking in with what's the most evidence-based, where are the wins, and having that balance between what disrupts someone who's gambling without any harms and what's useful for people who have more problems. And something like a pop-up message is quite good, because it doesn't really disrupt people too much. You know, it's not going to restrict a player who doesn't have problems, but it does have that check-in and benefit from someone who is having more difficulty. At the end of the day as well, though, it's not going to solve the problem for that person.
It sounds, at least on face value, incredibly mild. You know, a very brief message that pops up. I'm assuming it's either up there for a period of time and then it goes away, or you can maybe, you know, click it off and off you go. It's interesting that hasn't been adopted widely, at least here in Australia.
It is quite mild. And with all of these measures, they're only going to be a piece of the puzzle. So we need to look at meaningful reform. And what I have seen shift, and certainly my research has shifted, is trying to move away from individual responsibility, the idea that people need to be informed and be able to make their own controls in the face of a product that is essentially designed to encourage time on device, and look at having more systemic changes. You know, what are the changes that need to happen at a product level, at an environment, in the way the product is designed, such that it's not only the individual that has responsibility, but that that product is actually altered to try and reduce some of those really habit-forming aspects. It's similar to, you know, infinite scroll on social media, which there's increasing community backlash against. You know, what is the role of the design? And there's more and more onus on governments and on industry providers to check in and say, well, is this product appropriate to be provided in its current way?
It's interesting, because in so many ways, psychology is what informed this variable reinforcement schedule, and along with, you know, making it, you know, incredibly compelling to play with lots of music, and you remove, you know, times and so on and so forth, or clocks. And now we're trying to use psychology to at least inform what could be done to try and at least stem the more problematic gambling side, not the, I suppose, you know, recreational, if I could call it that.
Well, gambling has been around. It's really the one activity that has been reliably across history. You know, there's ancient Greek representations of gambling. There's gambling in all societies in fairly similar formats. So it's not the psychologists invented gambling. And it's just as, you know, any company or technology company is allowed to use psychology to develop their products, it's up to the regulators to think, you know, what are the potential harms here? We're seeing similar things now with social media and other online products and AI. Unchecked, and industry is obviously going to do something to maximize their revenue. And so that's why it's really important that the regulators step in and put limits in place on what is considered appropriate from a societal point of view.
What are some of the policies that your research has potentially pointed toward in terms of what you think would be good for, whether it's the individual, the community? I know you mentioned trying to step away from the individual responsibility and look at more systemic approach.
So I've been involved in some research looking at cashless gambling, or more accurately described as account-based gambling. And we do, this is where people have to register an account. So you have to verify your identity and then you know who is playing gaming machines. So we already have account-based gambling in Australia. It's been around for many, many years. It is the model that's used for online wagering. So everyone with a, you know, a sports or race betting account has an account through which they gamble. It hasn't been around for gaming machines. Well, it's been available, but it hasn't been mandated for gaming machines, which is still a highly cash-based industry. So account-based gambling is also a way to move away from cash. So for the generations who no longer carry cash, it's you know, a way to allow these people to still access gaming machines. But it is going to have some difficulty because, as with any behavioral change, you know, there's a preference for status quo. So having people adopt a different way of doing it is unlikely to happen in a voluntary fashion. And we have to be very careful with account-based gambling, particularly where it's cashless, because we know that when people spend money in a digital format, whether it's a, you know, a card or a debit or an account transaction, that they tend to spend more money because the money isn't as salient. They're not thinking as much about the spend and what the meaning of that is. So we need to have restrictions in place to counter that. So things like delays and limits. And the benefits of account-based gambling is it allows us to provide activity statements to help people track their gambling spend and, again, use that self-referential feedback. Every month saying, this is how much you're gambling. This is what's affordable to you. Do you want to set a limit? So the benefits of the account are that they allow a whole suite of other harmonization measures to be put in place, and that would be beneficial. However, again, it's all somewhat hypothetical because until something's in place, it's difficult to test it and it's unlikely to be voluntarily adopted. So there's all these different ways in which research is informing policy, but ultimately we also need to look at evaluation of policies, either before or after or both, they're actually put in place.
That's very interesting because I know when I'm wearing my clinical hat and I'm working with clients who are having difficulties around gambling, and one of the most initial things that I do is really ask them to begin exploring, or I suppose observing their spending, not trying to change behavior, but just purely recording, almost like a bit of a monitoring, and that in and of itself is quite powerful. It's not trying to do behavior change, but rather just create an awareness, because often I think with the different biases we hold in our mind, you know, we can obviously have confirmation bias as an example, and recall the time that we won big. But we don't necessarily recall as vividly the time when we lost big. So it's quite interesting. That would be an absolutely fantastic model. But part of that challenge, as you mentioned, is testing it would require it being adopted. And is there reluctance in testing because of that conflicted sort of nature of that's great revenue source, and therefore, you know, it kind of jeopardizes the possibility of that revenue if it worked.
Well, I'll pick up a couple of things you've mentioned, and that's we do know from research that we've conducted that people are absolutely abysmal at knowing how much they spend. And we know this is what we see in treatment, that people have no idea how much they're spending. They tend to reflect very much on the winnings and forget or minimize how much it's actually cost them, or just simply not calculate that when they're thinking about their spend. So we know that people are typically, you know, 10x off. They just are completely inaccurate in how much they're spending. When we ask people how much they're gambling and we look at their accounts, they're not at all useful information that self-report. So that's why these feedback statements are really important. So one piece of research we're actually doing is looking at how to evaluate these, you know, if we can provide self-accurate information back to people. Just as you say, not as a trying to behave, change people's behavior, but to enable that, what I originally said was a necessary part of gambling appropriately, which is informed decision making. That if you don't know how much you're spending, it's impossible to be making an informed decision of how much you should spend next time. And it's unusual in any type of consumer product that there isn't a clear documentation of how much you're spending. Imagine if you did your weekly grocery shopping and you got everything in your basket, and they just swiped your credit card and you said, can I have a receipt? And they go, nah, you know, you go around and you figure it out, or we'll give you a receipt, but we won't tell you the net outcome. We'll just list it, but you get your calculator out, and or you figure out a way to work out what your overall, you know, spend is. Oh, but we're going to give you some promotions. We know it's cost you this much money, but we'll give you some freebies. There'll be some free spins in there. We'll give you a free packet of this, a free packet of that. So that's going to offset some of those costs. So don't worry even if you do calculate it up, but we'll give you free things. So it's less than that. We don't want to tell you exactly how much, but trust us, it's some bit less. And then you expect people to somehow, and then they're going to three different shops and they're all doing the same thing. How is anyone supposed to know how much they're spending? And I might ask you, you know, do you know how much you spend a week on, you know, if you add up all your takeaway coffees and takeaway food, like just that simple thing of how much do you spend on, you know, ready-made meals that you purchase in a single week? Would you be able to kind of give me a rough ball? Like, how much is your coffee? Is your coffee, is it $3.50, $4.10? Like,
look, if I did an individual coffee, I could probably tell you fairly accurately. But the moment we're going to say, what does it look like over a week or a month? You know, I think you're right. Probably 10x out. You have no idea.
Like, and you probably know my coffee's probably between $3 and $5. Like, so probably it's about that. Well, you know, we're thinking about gambling. You can sit for a gambling session and spend anywhere between $5 and $5,000. Yeah, that is the level of variability we're talking about. So it's not like, oh, on average, it's about $200 a shop. You know, we're not talking about even a predictable expense here. It's not your subscription to Netflix, oh, it's this much per month and it's just set there. We're talking about a hugely variable, you know, activity. So the only real way to be accurate about it is either not doing it very often or not doing it at all. So if you only gamble once a month, you might be able to do it.
Sure.
But they're not the people we don't really care. Like, if you're only gambling once a month, that's like fine. Like, not who we're looking at. If we're looking at, by definition, targeting a group of people who are gambling regularly, you know, once a week or more, then by definition, they're gambling multiple times, hugely variable amounts. Sometimes they're going to win. Sometimes they're going to lose. It is impossible for them to calculate. But for some reason in society, we feel fine about the fact that this is happening. And that just makes no sense to me, because I can't think of any industry where people would be, you know, happy to not have a disclosure of how much they're spending. Yet for some reason, this is tolerated in gambling. So one of the areas we're working on is to try and encourage people to get an accurate activity statement where they can. This only works currently for online wagering, but to actually check those and review them, because that's the bonkers part as well, is that the gambling companies are currently sending out statements and not everyone's even reading them. So people are actively not seeking this information. And this makes sense from a treatment-seeking perspective, because we know by the time someone is experiencing gambling harm, they don't want to know. They know it's a lot, but they don't want to know exactly how much. So that makes sense to us. But again, it's the people before they get to that point in time that we really want to start working around educating. And again, not being responsible for everything, but there is a level of individual responsibility where we are saying to people, look, You're not responsible for the product, but you are responsible for your actions. So you need to know how much you're spending on this product. And we're going to try and make that easier for you. But we need to kind of encourage people and build up this idea that the venues and the, you know, the operators should also be encouraging this too.
And Sally, I can also see where if someone is not aware of their expenditure in that, they also are more and more likely to continue down that road. It can slip away easier. If you were to notice your spend going up, and let's say you're an early gambler, so to speak, you've only started in the first several months, and then you can recognize, hey, my goodness, you know, I over the course of the last 3 months have lost X. That could potentially be quite compelling, or at least goes back to that first question that you asked in terms of, do you know how much you are spending, whether it's a pop-up or it's an account?
Yep.
Obviously, the account sounds much superior in terms of I think, motivation for not even change, but motivation to question and go, is this what I want to be spending? Because for some people, they might continue and say, this is well worth the spend. This is where I get lots of recreation and enjoyment from, and fair enough.
Absolutely. And then the intention of the tool that we're working on is just that, to be non-judgmental. It's actually a tool for people. We're not trying to get people to change. We're agnostic. If you want to gamble, fine. If you want to spend what you're spending, what we do want to do is to make sure people are checking in. So part of the tool is to help people to actually track it. We're also looking at, you know, if we ask people to make a hypothesis, so we want to tell me how much you're gambling, And then I'll show you the information. And you just have a little think about whether you're accurate or not. We're not even going to tell you like how far off you are, because we don't want to be too shocking or confronting for people. But just that idea of, ooh, you know, sort of having this really non-judgmental, it's not overly gentle, but it's not saying to people you need to change or anything's wrong with that, but it's for people to have their own reflection on how they're reacting to that. So we're also saying to people, great, you know, you've spent $300 in the last month on gambling. That is about, you know, three tanks of petrol a night in a hotel in a major city. You know, we're just making comparisons. So again, if you want to spend that money on gambling, great. But just so you're aware, there is an opportunity cost. And the same as, are you aware how much, if you do that every month, you know, this is going to be how much it is over a period of 12 months. So we're just giving this information feedback for people. Again, it's not saying do anything different, but it's making people aware of the fact if you choose to continue, this is what you're doing. And that's what we just want to do, is have this informed decision making that then people can be thinking about themselves. And again, it's not going to solve anything. It's not trying to do a huge behavioral change, but it's helping people to be in the frame of mind where they can accurately for themselves make decisions for their own behavior.
Hmm. You mentioned that, and it was potentially just a throwaway line that people can be 10x out in terms of their assessment or guess estimate of how much they are spending. Is there research out there that has looked at that in terms of how far it is? Maybe it is 10x or maybe.
Yeah, I've done research with my colleagues only for online wagering, because we don't have the data for actually, we are getting some studies looking at EGM. So we are going to have a study looking at how accurate people are in their self-report. We haven't got the data yet, but it's not great. The proportion of people who can accurately estimate how much they're spending is less than 10%. And that's, you know, within sort of a range. So most, you know, we're looking at 90% of people being inaccurate in their estimations. And problematically, if you think about all of the policies that are based on prevalent studies of self-report studies of people telling us how much they spend, that essentially tells us that all that research is fairly, you know, it's difficult to take it too seriously when people are telling us themselves how much they're spending, because we know they're not very accurate. Mm. So it is important to start having a better system of tracking for individuals and for policy as well.
And is there any understanding of how far out the average person is? I know on an individual basis it can vary quite considerably, but are we out sort of twofold? Are we out?
It depends on, and I have to look up the specific study now. I've been quoted off without the study in hand. It depends on also how frequent a gambler you are. So obviously, the more intense gambler you are, it's going to impact how accurate you are. Now, it gets to a point where some people are actually very accurate. So there are some people who do track their gambling quite, and this is probably more for wagering. We haven't looked at it very much in gaming machine, but for wagering, some people do track their gambling and they take it that aspect of it quite seriously. And certainly it's the number one aspect, just number one strategy people will tell us that they would like to do. So if when we ask people, and we have done research talking directly with individuals, because it's important to, if we're trying to do strategies to reduce harm, we talk to people that we're trying to impact. So we do a lot of research called co-design, where we ask people, you know, what would you like? If we're going to build a tool, what tool would be helpful? And tracking your data is a thing that the number one thing that people ask for, which shows us that they are aware that they need assistance with this.
Mm. I can also see that people who are invested in gambling in terms of they enjoy it, that would potentially become part of the enjoyment, that they can view how they're tracking, how they've gone month over month, you know, how that's working for them, the different strategies they're putting in play. So it could be not only an informative amount of information around consent, that they understand it, but it could also make it quite enjoyable. And I assume it makes it a little bit easier for someone to go out and say, well, maybe I will approach my gambling differently because I'm looking for a different approach. If you're not even aware of it, how much is going down the drain, that's a judgment. Let me say that again. How much is being lost? Then you don't even have an opportunity to consider that.
Yeah, and I've just pulled up the study. So we had a look at 652 participants, 48 of them, so around 7% were accurate within a 10% margin of their frequency of gambling. And amongst the people talking about how much they'd won, the net outcome, only 21 of 514, so 4% of people were accurate in terms of their outcome, in terms of within a 10% margin. So, and I don't have the figures off the top of my head of how far out they were, but
Sure.
it's not great. 4% of people.
Neither frequency or quantity.
No, it's not looking good for individuals. And that's for wagering where you can actually track it. With EGMs, it's just simply very, very difficult to track how much you're spending, particularly. And that's one of the downsides of cash is although it's more salient for people, it's actually also easier to spend and kind of, one 20 after another 20. And then if you start putting bigger notes in, it just all kind of gets a little bit washed out for people. So, but it's also tricky as well of how people think about spend. Because a lot of people will think, okay, well, I put $20 into the machine. And like the person who I saw when I was working in the pubs, they had $900 in credits, but they walked out with nothing. Now, did that person lose $20 or did they lose $900? So it's sort of, your framework of thinking, but if you had $900 worth of credit, that's money you could have withdrawn. But a lot of people just play it out. So even the winnings are often reinvested. So they're not actualized for someone in any sort of meaningful way. So there's a lot of ways the machines are kind of designed to, and it's similar to lots of different types of gambling. The money stays in the account. So we need to sort of, again, get people to think about these sorts of concepts and they're making those decisions. That's their own decision there as well. But the machines aren't necessarily automatically paying out the big wins either. So we need to think about this kind of balance of how can we design things. And there have been some shifts. So for example, there's now legislation that says you have to display the credits as money. So it no longer says, you've got, 9,000 credits in the machine. It doesn't, it's not even in cent dollar. It now has to at least be in dollar and cent value. But it's still really tricky to work out, what's the value of a free spin? How much you're getting back in bonuses, what's the bet size? There's a lot of variability and there's so much on the machine that when you've got, the credits up in this tiny little bar here, but you've got everything else flashing and, the arguably less important information is competing with the amounts that you're spending.
Always been fascinated, not that I've been around poker machines, but from time to time I have observed people, friends use them. And it's so interesting that even when, for example, there's a dollar bet, the machine sings as though you've won and it goes, doo-loo-loo-loo.
Yep.
However, you've only won 90 cents.
So
So
that's the
it
good old
doesn't say
losses
you've
disguised
lost
as
10.
wins. Yep.
It's so fascinating, all these small little incremental things that are occurring. And obviously, being a psychologist, I enjoy looking at all of that. But there are so many little strategies that are, in play. And as you say, credits being, very small, even the use of it being called a credit. We can see many factors that overlay one another and make it incredibly enticing.
It does. And look, there's an interaction. Certainly not everyone who plays a gaming machine or gambles is going to experience a problem, and most people don't. So we need to be careful about
Yes.
saying the machines themselves are addictive or the product is addictive. The reality is most people don't have a problem. However, a lot of people do. Of people who gamble, the worst I've seen is around half of people who gamble have some level of harm, which is from a nationally representative study. However, that has a pretty low criteria for what harm is. So that's sort of saying anything at all, you indicate some sort of harm. So that's, I think, a little bit disingenuous in the sense that harm is pretty, if you go to the movies and you spend money, you're out of pocket. Is that a harm? So we have to be careful about taking overinflation. But even without that, there are, substantial numbers of Australians who are directly harmed. And then the people who are around those people. So it's not the product themselves in and of themselves, but there certainly is an interaction and the products are risky and they do have people do develop harms in relation to them. So there is a responsibility as a society, and that includes the government, the industry, but also the community that's tolerating them. We're electing people based on their policies. It's certainly, different governments have campaigned on different gambling reforms. So it's the community that at the end of the day needs to help shape the reforms if that's what they're looking for. There's only so much that, individuals can do.
Has there been an increase in harmful use with the accessibility through smartphones? The fact that, I can right now download an app, I can register an account, I can load up money, I can start being active, and it's exciting and so on. And just talking about the harm component, not necessarily the non-harmful, has that increased with online gambling?
Arguably, the prevalence rate of gambling problems has stayed fairly static in Australia, but it's around or a little bit less than 1%. So there's just a methodological issue of it being hard to measure. We see in treatments, we've seen online gambling. So that's usually wagering and racing and sporting gambling. That has increased. It was essentially none. We didn't see any clients on this 10, 15 years ago. And now it's around, 30% of clients. So it is a shift. More people, particularly young men, are coming in. It used to be all racing or wagering machine. Now we're seeing sports betting as an issue. And anecdotally, it's something that's been talked about a lot. So people are seeing the harms, and that's what we would expect. These harms are sort of anecdotally seen in the communities before you see it trickle into treatment or you see it represented in the stats. So yes, if the problem's increasing overall, because there's lots of shifting demographics, gaming machines are less attractive to younger people. So is there a sort of an aging out of the population, but then they'll change. So it's a dynamic issue. But yes, we are seeing more harms being associated with online wagering and online sporting events.
Has there been any improvements over time that has reduced, harm, or we're looking
That's
at a social
question.
Aspect, for example?
I've seen improvements, I would say, in my time in this area. There's much more community awareness and conversation around gambling. There's much more awareness of significant others. So it used to be very much just treatment. You're an individual, you put up your hand, you get treatment. There's now more consideration around the harms for other people, the family members, the significant others. And there's more discussion of harms at a broader level and this kind of spectrum idea that it's not only, you've got a gambling problem. Okay, great, you go over there. There's more community and government conversation around the spectrum of harm, and the harm occurs at different levels, and there's mild and moderate and severe harms. People change over time. So there is more awareness of this. However, I haven't seen a lot of resourcing for to sort of account for that. So most of the resources are still for people who have more developed gambling problems. There are fewer tools like the ones I'm talking about to help people calculate their budgets. However, there are some. So that they're emerging, and it's this kind of competing priority and competing resources, how much can we focus on different things? And I think that within the constraints of the availability of people and organizations working on this, we haven't seen enough in the what I would call sort of the secondary prevention. So not prevention at a population level, but of the targeted at-risk group, how can we help these people, reverse their potential direction towards worsening harm?
I know that our time is very limited. I've got two questions. The first one will be around where can people find out more and learn about this topic and potentially get into the work themselves. And secondly, will be your hopes for the future around how people could be informed or what policies you would like to hopefully see over time.
Yeah, well, the first question is you can follow me on LinkedIn at Sally Gainsbury, or on Twitter, I'm Dr. Sal Gainsbury. Also at the University of Sydney Gambling Treatment and Research Clinic, we have a clinic website. There's also a technology addiction page, and they have links to a whole lot of webinars that I've been on. My own webinar series, the Technology Risk in Gambling webinar series, which is available for free on YouTube through the Brain and Mind Center YouTube channel. So there's lots of resources out there. I'm also happy for people to contact me directly. And in terms of, the wish lists, I think that I've seen policy change in response to community sentiment. So the more people who are calling, politicians at the end of the day are going for at the moment, electable issues. So the more people who want to see a change, I'm calling on them to do something about it. I'm not saying everyone has to get up and campaign or march or protest, but start thinking about, where your vote goes, what you're asking your local people to do, and how you can be involved in change, because everyone has some role to play, whether it's within your own workplace. If you see a practice you don't think is consistent, there are still lots of workplaces that have big celebrations on Melbourne Cup Day. Let's all celebrate a massive horse race. Well, we know from statistics that there's going to be people in every workplace that have been either directly or indirectly impacted by gambling harm. So just think about, is it appropriate to be celebrating a horse race in your workplace? To, having conversations with people or, making changes in your own life, being aware of the risks and talking about it. So one survey we're doing at the moment and a campaign we have is to try and have more people be asked about their gambling, because we know that people tend to seek treatment if they do 9 to 10 years after the problems develop. Now, during that time, they've sat down in front of doctors and social workers and, employees and a whole host of different organizations and people. And has anyone asked them about their gambling? So if you work in a profession or organization that has contact with people in any sense of the way, we've got hairdressers, for example, that people are talking to, oh, my, so and so is gambling or this and that. Have the conversations, destigmatize talking about gambling and seeking help, and ask questions to people in a supportive, non-judgmental way, because help is freely available in pretty much everywhere in the world. There's free, confidential help, either online or in person. But we have a lot of stigma around seeking help. So everyone who's listening can be part of that conversation. Don't be afraid to talk about it. Ask questions, probe gently and in a supportive manner, so we can have earlier identification and get more people to try and reduce their gambling harms.
Very well said. And I can see the value of trying to make this a conversation that is ongoing, whether it's on the individual level or from a policy level, talking to our ministers and the like, and looking for change. I think that's how we achieve things like, having labels on our food so we know what we're eating. There's then therefore a bit of informed consent about what I want to put in my body. When I'm trying to purchase something from the grocery store, it's so much easier to calculate what it is per 100 grams when they tell me, because it's otherwise impossible. I'm not a mathematician. And so, informed consent is about how the world interacts with humans. And I can see something like this, isn't going out and taking away anyone's rights or saying you shouldn't. It's non-judgmental, but really saying, if you're going to participate in that, can you do it in an informed way? So I love those ideas because it's something that's sensitive to people's wants, desires, pleasures, and also addressing it where sometimes it can have detrimental effects. So, Sally, thank you so much for your time today. I wish we had more time, and thank you for those resources as well. I think it's a great opportunity to look into this topic further and find out more.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the conversation. It's been great chatting.